Public Safety Subcommittee for April 25th, 2005, for the purpose of a hearing on House Bill 5061, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, public hearing. And colleagues, I'm going to ask that we strike the second item from the agenda, which is the House Bill 5062, DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Fee Bill, which we will instead hear on tomorrow. And with that said, Mr. Wilson, would you like us to, would you please walk us through the documents that you've prepared?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, in front of you is the memo, which is our, at least my standard phase two memo. I'll let the agency, if they wish, review the agency mission and primary programs and customers. In terms of budget notes, e-board actions, and audit findings, there was one budget note in the last year or last session, 2003 session, and it really was a budget note that was designed to sort of a progress report on opening the new facility, the cost of opening that new facility, the progress on the 16-week course, the cost of implementing that, as well as progress in the integration of state police training into the curriculum of DPSST, all of which you've heard or will hear from the agency in their presentations. They, as my records show, they only visited the e-board once, which was for the report we just talked about, or that I just described. And there was only one audit by the Division of Audits, and that was the usual change of director audit when someone leaves as director of an agency. Division of Audit goes in and takes a look at, basically closes out that portion of the agency's history, making sure that the agency's assets are protected, that the former director didn't leave with a computer or anything like that. So there was really no significant findings. The audit did note that the agency should look into strengthening its information systems user access management. Revenue history, the big change here is the change from CFAA funding. This is the primary or first priority use of criminal fines and assessment or CFAA funding is for public safety training, of which DPSST has generally been the most or the largest user. As you know, that the governor's budget put all of CFAA revenue into the general fund, and in turn, now DPSST has a significant general fund appropriation. Expenditure history, I have a chart there on the second page of the memo. I'm just showing you the change. There is significant growth in this agency. Again, it's there for two primary reasons, or really three primary reasons. The first being a major increase in debt service. That amount will drop by roughly $3.4 million from the governor's budget when you get to work session. But also increasing is also some of the administrative support services. And it's not necessarily admin increasing. It's more in the operations of the new facility, which is a new brand new responsibility for the department, as well as the increase housing, food service, security, those kinds of cost in the operation of the training facility. And the fire training has an increase of, I believe, about $1.2 million in this budget also, and I'm sure the agency will be describing that increase to you. In terms of major policy and budget issues,
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Doug, if you go back, we're seeing the changes we're seeing in the 0507. You've described that.
Mm-hmm.
In your handout, you say there's also expected to be major roll-up costs for 2007-2009 in criminal justice and admin support. So are we looking at how much? Do you have any ideas, projections?
Let me get to the next page. I'll catch up with you.
Good. Thank you.
The subcommittee had a number of questions regarding training in general of public safety. who really making sure there's no overlap. I think Mr. Minnis will be discussing a little bit of that in front of you in his portion of the presentation. There was, the role of state police, local police, sheriff, and DPSST.
Mm-hmm. And I would just add to what Mr. Wilson has said to further clarify that, as I recall the subcommittee's discussion, our concern was also about making sure that we are getting the maximum coordination, collaboration between and amongst agencies. So it was something more than overlap, than about overlap.
That's true.
Just to make that point.
The subcommittee had some discussion around whether the 16-week basic law enforcement training was sufficient and asked the agency to come back and at some point in time and talk about the cost of going to the national average of 22 weeks. The current is 10 weeks, so the jump to 22 weeks would be very significant and at least at this stage would probably outpace the agency's ability to move that quickly to something of that length. The third bullet talks about the basic law enforcement training from the current 10 weeks to 16 weeks. The cost in this budget is $2.6 million, rolling up to $3.5 in 07-09. In terms of the new training facility, costs $2.8 million in the governor's recommended budget, increasing to $6.1 million in 07-09. So there's major roll-up there. A lot of that roll-up is includes the impact of the housekeeping and food service costs for going to the 16 weeks. Those are where those costs are in the budget. I think the subcommittee has discussed this briefly. There are ongoing discussions underway relating for the DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, to take over the responsibilities of the Board of Investigators. It's one reason that budget was delayed until that is worked out and agreed to. That would take policy legislation or policy-related legislation at the same time.
And Director Minnis, are you prepared to give us an update today on where you are with the Board of Investigators discussion?
No, I'm sure I'll give you as much information as I know.
Okay. When we get to that.
Somewhat convoluted, but
all right.
We're on one track, and hopefully everybody else is on the same.
Okay. Thank you.
During the presentation by the agency, they did express that regional training remains a priority for them, but wasn't funded at a level that I think they would say that is needed out there. In terms of sort of where the House and Senate versions are, there is a $2 million difference in between those two budgets. It's in the agency or in the operation of the facility area, at least in that terms of that line item. At least two of the options discussed that could be options to implement this reduction would be requiring local agencies or trainees to pay for their own room or board. That was brought forward and discussed for a short term or short time in the subcommittee during phase one, or delaying the implementation of the 16-week law enforcement training. Those would be two options to get to the $2 million Senate cut. The House version generally follows the governor's budget. I did say earlier that this budget will be reduced. I believe it is $3.4 million general fund in terms of debt service reduction, that given more up-to-date information, and I believe the sale has taken place on the remainder of the COPs that are necessary for the new facility. So that number should be coming to a final number in the very near future. And finally, there is a fee bill that we've delayed at least till tomorrow for discussion dealing with private security program fees. And Madam Chair, I believe that is my portion of the presentation.
Okay. I just want to say before we go to Senator Devlin and then to Mr. McGee, that looking at the differences in the House and Senate versions of the budget and looking at where the Senate version reduces the amount for operations and then also lays out how that reduction could take place. Trainees paying for room and board or delaying the implementation of the 16-week. Both of those give me heartburn, just to be frank about it. They're not options that I necessarily support. I would need to hear from, and although I do respect, you know, the co-chair making the decision distinction that he's made. With that said, I would like to hear from Director Menace, again, when you get to that place in your presentation, what that reduction means, again, on the record, what taking that reduction to operations would mean as we try to, as we move toward rolling out this 16-week expansion. Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are a couple of items. One, in terms of your heartburn over those two items, they listed actually three in there, and one of them obviously is to reduce, not to expand the number of weeks. One of them is to have the trainee, but the third is actually to have their local agency pick up part of the cost. And I've always thought that that's something we have to at least consider as we expand training, that there should be a more proportional share in the cost of that training being distributed between local and state government. The other question, though, I had is a much broader question, and that is maybe not directly at this budget, but ultimately, when will we face the ultimate decision on criminal fines and assessments and whether we reverse the governor's direction or whether we don't?
Madam Chair, actually, I don't have the crystal ball in front of me to predict that, but just as a note, when the governor did make that change in his budget, keep in mind that at least in terms of the DPSST budget, we have to actually add a little bit more than just the switch to make sure there's carryover. It is probably the only budget right now that we see CFA funding where we have to do it because there is a delay. So, and I think we estimate $2.5 million that we would have to add in addition to the general fund that's in here right now to make sure they have enough to transition into the next biennium.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So, but before we could deal with any of the budgets that receive CFAA funds, we would probably have to have made that decision in one way or another. I mean, they would be getting CFAA funds plus some general funds, obviously, in this case, but the decision will have to be made sometime
soon
before we can start passing out any budgets with CFAA funds in them. Or
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, you could always go back and change it. But in terms of making it easiest to understand and stuff, you're probably right. If that is what the outcome will end up being.
I want to pick up on Senator Devlin's other comment about counties picking up some of the costs. Again, it's not listed here as an option that at least one of the co-chairs is currently looking at. I believe we already looked at that option, and we got some information back from the counties that pretty much took that off the table, as I recall.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might comment, it does say requiring local agencies or trainees, and I expected the reaction from counties that we received. I would expect the same reaction from cities. No and hell no. I'm sorry about that language. But I still think with the expanding cost of operating the facility, there has to be some discussion about a different type of sharing of the cost of operating the facility.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
We can reopen that discussion. Representative Hansen and then Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm obviously very sympathetic to counties and local governments, but just from a technical standpoint, and I'll ask the director this, if we levied the cost on the trainee and said that we were going to require trainees to be responsible for their own board and room, isn't that something that would be passed on to the governments by most agencies that have collective bargaining agreements by the time you get through one bargaining? or already probably is covered, that if you required a, say in Portland, if you required a Portland police cadet to pick up their own training, that would be, that the collective bargaining agreement would say the city would have to pay for that, wouldn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a very complex question that you just asked. It depends on how you interpret it. If the person's already hired by an agency, and then you're going to require them to pay a portion of it, and that employee or other peer employees are represented by a collective bargaining organization, then clearly, at least in my estimation, that would become an issue. If you're talking about pre-employment charges, which would be similar to the California open enrollment system, there are federal laws that create problems because you cannot utilize background investigations or pre-employment hiring standards in some of those tuition-based programs. And the difficulty that it raises is, as California currently has, where anybody can go to the police academy in California if you're willing to pay for the cost. The problem is that you're unemployable in many instances because they have prior convictions for felonies or different types of criminal convictions and behavior that would preclude them from being employed. Hence, the California Post organization that governs and oversees police training in California provides a lot of training and curriculum development for individuals who will never end up in police training. It's a bit of a conundrum. You can go either way you want, but it's like a balloon. You push one direction, it ends up getting larger on the other side. But where they're represented by a group, if it's an employee who's hired, I'm convinced that the local government is
looking. Well, for police training, isn't everybody that attends your school already hired?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, in Oregon, correct, they are.
Now, there's some other circumstances that would apply to, like, volunteer fire people and fire professionals and stuff that I would think most people are pre-hired.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. Fire certification is voluntary also, not mandatory.
Representative Hanna.
Madam Chair, I'm going in a different direction, so if you want to stay with this, my question has...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know what the food service is going to cost? And I'm assuming staff is going to pay for their food that they eat there. I'm having, from a... It's my belief that the person attending the course should at the minimum be paying... Someone should be paying for the food because that's not part of their salary. I don't know how you would get into the lodging cost reimbursement. But I don't believe any of the duty officers are paid giving food allowance for their duty day. And I'm assuming, as I said, that staff is going to be paying for their food, so that the amount of money should have been determined, I'm assuming. And that, I know what assuming means. So.
Did you wish to respond?
Madam Chair and Representative, the word assumption is a complex word. It can get everybody in trouble. We had this discussion briefly about staff eating in the cafeteria, the folks working for my agency, and I don't believe that those numbers are worked out yet, but I believe the assumptions in the RFP that has been issued assumes the student eating lunch is not... It assumes students eating and not staff, and I think that the general feeling in the agency is it's unlikely that most staff would eat in that particular lounge because many of them even today bring their own lunches, even though food service is available at Western Oregon University. So it isn't a cash cow for us in that respect.
Mr. McGee.
Madam Chair, Representative Wigman, in response to the other part of your question, I don't know what the policies of local agencies are, but at the state level, if an employee is on travel for a period of time, it would be the state's responsibility to pay a per diem for food. So I would assume in many cases the local governments would have the same expectation and that it would not be something that the employee would be paying while they were in residence at the academy.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair. The other part of the question is, do we know how much we're talking about for food services? I mean, how much money are we talking about? And it may be, if that number is such a significant amount, it may be worth going back to the counties or something and saying.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, for this budget, we have $847,000 built in for for the food service program, which includes the food, the staff to run it, the entire operation for the second year of the biennium. I assume it would, if those costs turned out to be accurate, once the operation's up and running, you'd double them for a full biennium.
Representative Hannah, and let me just point out that we are still commenting, I believe, on the LFO document report, and we still need to get to the
this question pertains
Mr. McGee's
to that.
Presentation.
Okay, this will be quick. Mr. Wilson, the $3.4 million reduction, was that in the debt service itself because of the cost, or did the were the bonds themselves structured in a different way?
Madam Chair and Representative Hannah, it was, I guess, the second. Keep in mind, when the governor's budget is put together, it's put together, you know, months and a year ahead. So as it got closer and closer to that sale, you had better estimates. The project cost has not changed, so it's the cost of financing. And maybe Mr. McGee has a little more knowledge in this than I do.
Just a brief follow-up. So what we're looking at is around $8.5 million instead of the $11.9 for debt service?
I believe that's right.
And when you get to it in the presentation, you can talk about it as well. I just want to make sure we get it. I'd like to know for this sheet so we get it right.
Are you ready to go?
Whenever you care.
Okay. Please go forward.
Thank you. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. You've got my handout. As we usually begin these, the second page will show you what the how DPSST fits into the total funds budget. Within public safety, of the $2.4 billion total funds, it represents about 2% of that budget. In terms of the general fund and lottery funds budget of $1.56 billion, it's again about a 2% level there as well. In terms of the governance principles, the majority of the agency, as you would expect, relates to the public safety principle. It was determined that the private security program was best included in the economic development principle as that went forward. Page 5 gives you a breakdown of the fund types that make up the governor's budget. Mr. Wilson indicated with the shift of CFAA, or criminal fines and assessment account, revenues to the general fund. Now, that makes up 69.5% of what the governor is recommending to you. 30.4% is other funds, and that consists of a number of different fund types. Again, there is some criminal fines and assessment account revenue here, which is essentially carry forward from the 03-05 biennium to the 05-07 biennium, either at the agency level or at the Department of Revenue level. There also is fire insurance premium tax revenue, which is increasing due to a legislative fix you put in place last session. Private security fees support that program entirely. The 911 telephone excise tax, the 75 cents that you're on your phone bill every month, that supports the training of telecommunicators and emergency dispatch personnel. There is a grant from the Department of Transportation for traffic safety purposes, and there is some carryover and certificates of participation that will be used to fund the construction project management as well as the ongoing costs of the construction itself. The small amount of federal funds, just $53,000 of those, represented Department of Homeland Security grants to present fire training courses.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McGee, would you have a sense for what the CFAA portion of this would be if it were like it was, if the funding were like it was?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, the switch would be the $28.2 million general fund would be criminal fines and
assessment. It would all be that.
It would all be.
Okay. Thank you.
Prior to this recommendation, this agency did not receive general fund.
Okay. Thank you. That clears that up.
Page 6 shows you the program units that the agency has broken into. The largest, the Administration and Support Services Unit, not only has the administration of the agency, it also has the operation of the new facility, including food service, maintenance, groundskeeping, all the costs that are required to operate a 250-acre academy on a 24/7 basis. It also includes the debt service on the bonds for the academy. So that's a very large percentage of what you see there. The Public Safety Memorial Fund, provides assistance to families of officers who are killed on duty or officers themselves who are permanently and totally disabled. The criminal justice unit, the law enforcement training, corrections training, parole and probation, the 911 training, all is provided in that unit. The fire training unit, that contains the fire program, which is primarily a coordination of training in the field. And the private security unit, which is fee-supported, regulates the private security industry, requiring training and certification. Moving on to page 7, showing you the budget categories. Personal service makes up about 40% of this budget. It's the folks that will run the academy and that will provide the training, do the certification, and administer the agency. There's a small amount of capital outlay for equipment. As we move to the academy, you will find, with a scenario-based, you'll find there's much more of equipment needs than currently exist. Service and supplies are about $11 million, or 27% of the budget. The small amount of special payments, again, is the Public Safety Memorial Fund payments to officers who are either killed or disabled. And again, the debt service, which in the governor's budget was $11.9 million, or 29.5%, is reduced to $9.9 million based on the sale that was just recently completed. And that reduction is really due to a couple of things. We were able to get a lower rate than we had projected when we did the initial. The rate came in at 4.29%. And that attributes significantly to the reduction. The reason we have a 3.4 general fund reduction is, in addition to the rate reduction, we also have capitalized interest carrying forward from 0305 in a larger amount than we had anticipated. So on a one-time basis, we're able to pay a portion of the debt service with other funds rather than have to pay it with general fund. Moving on to page 8, the table that shows you the budget history going from the 1999-2001 actuals, when this was about an $18 million agency, again, all other funds, with primarily CFAA and the fire insurance premium tax, through the construction in the 2001-03, where you see the construction limitation, the current biennium, and then the increase, the governor's recommended budget, which was originally $28.2 million, adjusted now to $24.4 million, primarily due to the debt service adjustment. Then the other funds decrease as a result of the shift, and then again the position increase as well as we move to the new academy. On page 9, the major policy issues, of course, we will open the new Public Safety Academy in mid-2006, about a year from now. The 16-week basic police course is scheduled to begin in January of 2007. We're paying the debt service and the certificates of participation sold to finance the academy construction. The fire training program is enhanced as we have increased fire insurance premium tax revenues that are collected in order to support fire programs. Here, the Department of State Police fire marshals program and the arson program in state police as well. You'll see enhancements, I think, in the state police budget as a result of that as well. We're continuing to fund the private security program and the public safety memorial fund at current levels, and the governor is proposing to transfer all criminal fines and assessment account revenues to the general fund and to fund all CFAA programs directly from the general fund. And if I could address Senator Devlin's question, we would be happy at some point, I wouldn't want to take away a significant amount of time from this agency's presentation, to meet with you and have a presentation on the governor's proposal for CFAA. We've done that with the subcommittee in the past. We think we have a compelling argument. We'd be happy to do that at your pleasure.
Let's plan on scheduling that. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. On page 10, Mr. Wilson said you'll be dealing with a fee ratification bill tomorrow, I believe. We have some changes we need to ask for that to limit the private security fee increases in the original bill as the agency is rolling those back, except for the fingerprint increases that are required to meet the increase in the State Department of State Police's budget. And there are also a very small amount of retired officer fees that were increased this by an AB ratified. I'll run very quickly through the technical adjustments here. As Mr. Wilson said, those are ones you'll consider in greater depth during your work session. But again, we are reducing the debt service by $3.4 million general fund and increasing the other funds limitation for debt service by $1.4 million. And that's, again, to reflect what the actual interest rates we were able to occur in the last sale. We do have some carry forward capitalized interest, and we do have some charges to other programs that are supported from dedicated revenue services. So you'll see that increase. In terms of the operation of new facilities, we have an adjustment that would result in a net reduction of $96 general fund, add a position, and reduce FTE by about 0.49. Basically, after getting closer to the opening of the facility, hiring a new facilities manager, the department determined they needed to readjust the positions that were being phased in the early part of 05-07. So three positions would be added, two would be delayed to the following biennium, and we'd move the months around on a couple of other positions. Service and supplies costs, we're requesting that those be shifted from general fund to other funds based on anticipated revenue from the Energy Trust of Oregon and the Business Energy Tax Credit. These are incentives that are provided to construction projects in order to promote the use of energy-efficient construction. And we have some opportunity to get some funds on a one-time basis that would offset some general funds next biennium. And finally, on the last page, we have a very technical adjustment to restore an intra-fund transfer that was inadvertently deleted in the governor's budget, and that would reduce general fund by $30,000, increase other funds by the same amount. And that would be the conclusion of my presentation.
Questions or comments for Mr. McGee? Director Minnis, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. If I understand the next direction, we're going to begin with phase two. Section six is in the tabbed binder that you should have. I don't know if you want to begin there. Madam Chair, I apologize. I've got a terrible cold and a splitting headache, so if I seem a little dull today, that's one of the, at least one of the reasons. So, Madam Chair, this section deals with budget drivers and environmental factors affecting the agency. The first one is relatively obvious to people who've lived in Oregon for a period of time. That's Oregon's population continues to grow. As the population continues to grow, so do demands on public safety. The number of public safety officers requiring training is increasing. The currently have about 33,000 public safety officers working in Oregon based on Employment Department estimates. Their estimate by the year 2012 puts that at 41,000 individuals working in that particular field. Oregon is also one of the lowest states with the lowest number of full-time state and local law enforcement officers responding to calls. In the state, prison population has also increased to some degree because of ballot measure 11. Some, of course, would describe much of the blame there, but notwithstanding that, the prison population is going up exponentially. This also then demands or increases demand for corrections training. We have a Madras facility, which I think this committee has been discussing with the Department of Corrections, a Lakeview facility, which has been completed in terms of its construction and getting ready to open, requiring training demands, and also the Ontario facility. And then military call-ups. Many of the folks working in the Department of Corrections and in law enforcement also serve in the National Guard and have been called to duty in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the country. This causes local governments in the state to have to backfill those positions, hire and train, and also puts a stress on this agency. We also believe that some of the public employee retirees employees in the public employee retiree system may wish to retire, thus increasing the number of individuals having to be backfilled within the system itself. Also, private security is an area within public safety that I think is going to have increased demands for their services, increased professionalism, in particular as we're looking at the post 9/11 terrorism environment that we currently live in. Insufficient revenue within the criminal fines and assessment account dollars is cited here. One of the issues, there are program reductions of been necessary as a result of the demand on CFAA, and you may hearken back to the discussion about how that was previously constructed, where I believe under the current construct about 67% of these dollars go into the general fund, 33% make up the public safety fund, and the fund in its origin was designed to fund police and public safety training, but there have been a number of groups that have gotten their nose in the tent or their nose in the trough or whichever you want to call it and have taken some of those dollars. So it's one of the areas that the public safety community is very jealous and wanting to protect in terms of a revenue stream. The cost related to the new facility, we've got just a little bit of discussion about the total cost for debt services being roughly $9 million in this current, $9.8 million. It's
the time we wrote this, it was 11.9. Cost also related to increase in basic police training to 16 weeks and integrating the Oregon State Police basic training program into the department. This is scheduled to begin January of 2007. Then also growth in the fire insurance premium tax revenues as a result of legislative changes in the last legislature have caused that fund to increase and have allowed us some opportunities to increase some fire training throughout Oregon, which at least from my perspective is needed based on wildfire issues. And we were having a drought. I don't know what happened to the drought, by the way. It just seems to be pretty wet out there right now. But I suppose those folks that live over in eastern and southern Oregon might also still be feeling the effects of that. The next section dealing with recent major changes. Legislative action during the mid and late 1990s resulted in program growth for the agency. Approximately 14 years ago, constituent base comprised of approximately 7,200 police, sheriff's deputies, corrections officers, and parole and probation officers. Current constituency exceeds 33,000. As I mentioned earlier, it's expected to grow to 41,000 by the year 2012. The mid-90s, again, citizens' demand for greater incarceration of offenders has resulted in the building of prisons. Increase of corrections deputies and correctional officers working within the system. Also in the mid-90s, there was the passage of Senate Bill 1145. You may remember that. It's, I think, an issue during this legislative session in terms of funding. Senate Bill 1145 kept certain felons at the local level being housed by the counties in a relationship between the state and the counties that to some degree has faltered. I think there are several counties that have opted out of 1145 now, putting the oversight of those offenders back into the purview of the state. The private security program was added to the department in the 1995 session. There were roughly 6,000 providers at that time. Currently, it's over 13,000. Fire training certification program was added to the department as a responsibility of DPSST coming from the state fire marshal's office. And a very significant change with respect to the National Fire Service Training Certification Standards being applied. This is an area within the agency where the constituency is very aggressive about trying to improve their standards. And again, I mentioned it's a voluntary standard, but there's an internal pressure among their peers to seek out training and to ensure competencies amongst their co-workers, and also to some degree driven by some insurance issues with local cities and counties who are unfortunately have suffered some severe losses in life, firefighters. A basic police course originally was limited to 8 weeks. In 1997, the agency was directed to increase the course to 16 weeks, which was then the national average. In 1999, we were able to expand to 10 weeks, but simply can't reach that particular goal until January of 2007. The national average stands today at 22 weeks. Agency's total underfund operating budget, not including capital construction, debt service, and financing costs, was reduced from $20,687,831 in the 2001-2003 biennium to $19,452,507 for the 2003-2005 biennium, representing a reduction of 6%, including 19 positions and 17.12 FTE. The program impacts were the following: eliminated a significant number of regional training opportunities, resulting in additional risk to officers in their communities; eliminated the accreditation unit, which increases liability exposure, not having it increases liability and exposure for state and local safety agencies when public safety actions are challenged in court, which they are from time to time; eliminated the distance learning program, which reduces the agency's ability to effectively use technology to provide training and to develop standardized scenarios; eliminated approximately one half of the funding for child abuse training, which increases the risk that officers will not meet statutory requirements for child abuse training before they assume specialized investigative assignments; and eliminated the DARE officer training program; also eliminated all funding for executive level training and for specialized in-service courses that were included in the DPSST budget for the Oregon State Police. And moving on. Cost control measures. The agency has, throughout this biennium, we've left a number of positions vacant.
some of the vacancies and having them left positions vacant has have resulted in some overtime costs as other personnel have to pick up those duties. The first year savings was approximately $204,600. Savings for the second year of the biennium is assumed to be significantly less because there's less turnover in positions. We've analyzed course enrollments to maximize the use of resources, and resulted in the cancellation of two scheduled classes. While the initial savings is approximately $196,000, this may be reduced when the annual review is done at the end of the biennium. And under the terms of our agreement with Western Oregon University, we must guarantee a minimum of 4,995 student weeks per year. That's a significant comment there, student weeks. The discussion you had about food and food service, those costs are assumed in those student weeks that we currently pay. The cost that we were talking about earlier are to some degree assumed within that number. Additional savings have been realized by reducing expenditures for student uniforms and being more restrictive with student meal cards. Estimated savings roughly $3,400. Workload for staff in the private security programs reallocated and reclassifying one position, abolishing another, resulting in a savings of roughly $22,000. We have reduced our use of state motor pool vehicles, resulting in a $9,600, or at least an assumed $9,600 savings per year, roughly $800 a month. Utilizing more interagency intergovernmental agreements with other state and local agencies has reduced our use of personal and professional services contracts for training delivery, sometimes meant to get higher workloads for training coordinators within the agency. Assumed savings is roughly $44,000. We transferred our mail processing to the Department of Administrative Services, publishing and distribution, roughly $2,200 savings to the agency. Printing and copying charges have been reduced by discontinuing color printing for graduation programs, saving $1,500, directing all staff to use electronic templates instead of paper letterhead, $350 a year in savings, or $350 per year, and distributing agency newsletter electronically instead of printing and mailing, worth $100 per year. And sending large jobs to the state printing shop for savings of roughly $7,200 a year. Reduced office supplies expenditures through various actions, including no longer providing return envelopes, discontinuing lamination of wallet cards, mandatory recycling of file folders, etc., and estimated savings roughly $1,300 a year. Canceled newspaper subscriptions for the savings of approximately $125 a year. Overall savings has been reduced by $46,000 as a result of rental cost due to termination conditions of our lease in Salem. And what that's saying is we had a lease in Salem that private security was party to. They were asked by, directed by the last legislative assembly to move back to our current facility. The lease continued, and we ended up paying lease payments way beyond the assumption that was in the budget. So that reduced our overall savings by $46,000. And, of course, we continue to try to find ways to save money where it's appropriate. We'll be getting into talking about some of the RFPs, the food service and maintenance and so on and so forth, landscape maintenance, excuse me, and security. We have purchased equipment for surplus property. Oregon Correctional Enterprises is playing a large role in the construction acquisition property for not the construction, but the acquisition property for the new facility. And their current discussions regarding the RFPs have involved the use of the qualified rehabilitation companies, the QRF individuals, and also utilization of the Oregon Minority Women and Emerging Small Business Companies. The Smart Buy program has been implemented, and there's a reduction of approximately $20,000 from our budget from an anticipated savings through this purchasing program. Next section, major budgetary issues, the CFAA funding and general fund. As was spoken to earlier, the CFAA, or criminal fines and assessment dollars, is assumed to be treated as if or roll into the general fund, and the agency would become a general fund agency. The $4.9 million CFAA, or criminal fines and assessment funds, are anticipated for carry forward from the current biennium, and I believe, Bill, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that's because we're transitioning a certain portion of the biennium will be funded from the criminal fines and assessment account to an ultimately leaving us with a general fund, so there is some carry forward the criminal fines and assessment dollars. Also increasing the basic training program, and the 1997 legislature authorized increasing the basic police course from 8 to 16 weeks. DPSSC has increased to 10 weeks. 16-week course is scheduled for implementation in January of 2007. However, it will still lag behind the national average of 22 weeks, and any future enhancements to training could require expanding the new facility and increasing the agency's operational budget. Integration of the Oregon State Police training, Oregon State Police and the Department of Public Safety standards and training, continuing to have discussions on a transition plan to integrate the Oregon State Police recruit training to the Oregon Public Safety Academy when the 16-week police training is completed. There's an appendix that identifies a letter written by Ron Rucker, the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. And we're continuing to have those particular discussions. And I might also note for the committee that I believe I said this in one previous meeting, our statutes governing the agency are found in Chapter 181. Chapter 181 gives the authority to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for the certification and training of all public safety officers in the state of Oregon, including the Oregon State Police. So the Oregon State Police do not have separate statutes authorizing them to provide their own training separate from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. However, we are continuing to try to negotiate at least some amicable settlement between the two of us, because I think it is in the best interest of both our department and the Oregon State Police in this migration to hopefully a better and more effective program. Also, contracting out for services. Budget was developed under the assumption that food service, custodial service, and security services will be provided by private contractors. The American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees represents the agency's classified employees, and they have indicated a number of occasions that they prefer that these positions be within that represented body and be state employees. Regional training, there is a high demand for what we're now calling advanced training, regional training throughout the state. Budget reductions have significantly reduced the agency's ability to deliver this training. Regional training provides for the delivery of specialized advanced maintenance training that's not part of the basic curriculum. Skills that are trained in law enforcement officers are in fact perishable, and ongoing maintenance training is necessary to maintain proficiency. The fire insurance premium tax funding we talked about a little bit earlier, again, is increasing due to some place changes, and hence the fire training component of the agency's budget is also growing to represent or to reflect the opportunities to increase fire service training in the state. Now we get to the fun part, budget detail. Budget detail, there's an Appendix E, which you may have already read or have access to. The criminal justice program, the program is responsible for training law enforcement officers, corrections officers, parole probation officers, 911 telecommunicators, and emergency medical dispatchers. It's also is responsible for implementing and maintaining standards, maintaining officer records, and providing accreditation certification services, notwithstanding the fact we had no position that was created. Base budget adjustments, there were none. Base budget equals $13,157,384. Essential packages included an increase for pension bond assessments, the standard adjustment for vacancy savings, standard inflation for overtime, temporary appointments, shift differential, and all of the differentials. Pays out of federal funds in the amount of $165,600 related to an anti-terrorism grant that has been discontinued. The standard inflation increases for services and supplies, and a technical adjustment to separate existing expendable property from IT-related expendable property. The net total increase for essential package, this essential package is $12,659. Package 070 reduces other funds by $3,429,801 and eliminates 17 positions and 17 FTE to match expected available revenue. Reductions include total elimination of the regional training unit, including 8 positions, elimination of 5 positions in the academy training unit, elimination of 2 positions in the curriculum section, elimination of 2 positions in the certification and records section, and elimination of leadership and child abuse training. Policy package is 090, reduces services and supplies by $508,950 based on a review of current biennium expenditures and anticipated savings from the Smart Buy program. And I believe, Bill, that's that's an assumption based on our past spending history, correct? Policy package 096 shifts funding from the Colonel Fines and Assessment account to the general fund in the amount of $9,316,536. Policy package 101 turns around and restores all reductions that were included in policy package 070. And the 070, again, for the committee, 070 reductions were based upon the assumption dealing with the available revenue in the criminal fines and assessment account and the historical split left over from the last biennium or the current biennium. And based on those projections, once we forecast our need, we ended up having to make and available resources, we had to reduce this amount, $3 million. Lost my place. It's here somewhere. $3,429,000. Policy package 103 phases out student housing payments to Western Oregon University at the end of June 2006. Establishes one receptionist position. It also includes a mass transit tax for existing positions that move to Salem, and includes rent charges to be assessed to the telecommunications program. This package results in a net decrease of $917,629. And although I probably can't explain the relationship to you, I think there is a relationship with the student weeks that you're seeing being paid for in our current modality and in the transition to the general fund, where it shows the cost for food and these kind of things that are provided currently by Western Oregon University. The policy package 104 includes 26 positions and 15.32 FTE to be phased in for the implementation of the 16-week basic police course. This package also includes mass transit tax, startup, and recurring costs related to the additional training and capital outlay for the purchase of one additional skid car. The package results in an increase of $2,062,287.
Thank you. Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Give Director Minnis a break. Director Minnis, how many of the 16-week courses are you anticipating having? Four? I'm assuming. Or what? A year, two, see, three, you have three.
The assumption is eight, but we don't start until January of 08.
Eight a year?
Eight a year.
So there'll be overlap.
That's correct.
And, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Mr. Director, Minister, how many, what's the maximum number in your, are you anticipating per class, per court?
Yeah, per class. We're assuming, I believe it's 35 per class. We can take up to 40, but we're assuming 35 because we have it's a fairly complex job to get reservations and get people actually to show up on our doorstep. We've had the unfortunate experience of having 42 people in a class. It really stresses both the classroom materials and also our coordinators and trying to coordinate training. So 35 is our ideal. We can go to 40.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Madam Chair, policy package 105 provides for the public safety training specialist 2-1 FTE to coordinate traffic safety training at a cost of $157,615. The position is funded with a grant from the Oregon Department of Transportation. It was previously funded through a limited duration position. The position is recommended to be established as permanent with the understanding that the position would be held vacant if the grant funds are not continued. And this is a federal grant that passes through the Department of Oregon Department of Transportation to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The position's been in existence for quite some time, and it's a very valuable position. I think that's the reason for the recommendation of making the position permanent. We have to go through a certain budget exercise every biennium, I believe, to get that position reestablished. Policy package 111 includes reclassification of seven positions that have been reviewed and approved by the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resources Services Division. Expenditure limitation is shifted to services and supplies to fund the reclassifications, and there's no increase in funding. Fire program. This program is responsible for training firefighters, for implementing and maintaining standards, and for maintaining firefighter records. Funding for this program is through the fire insurance premium tax. revenues transferred from the state fire marshal. Base budget adjustments, the fire insurance premium tax transfers increased by $157,747 to leave a cash balance to cover 2 months of operating revenue and 8% personal services. The base budget equals $1,549,451. Essential packages include an increase for pension bond assessments, standard adjustments for vacancy savings, inflation overtime, inflation for services and supplies, and a technical adjustment to separate existing expendable property from IT-related expendable property. Total net increase in this essential package is $13,896. Policy package 090 in this area, fire service, reduces services and supplies by $1,782 for anticipated savings from the Smart Buy program. Policy package 103 includes rent at the new facility, mass transit tax for positions that will move to Salem, and an adjustment for interfund transfers for central administration services. The package results in an increase of $44,748. Package 108 establishes five positions, five FTE to improve fire training, certification records management, funding for additional leadership training classes, and capital outlay for a live burn trailer. Total increase is $1,167,909 to be entirely funded with fire insurance premium tax revenues anticipated under the current tax rate. Policy package 111 provides $6,563 for reclassification of the fire training supervisor position, which was reviewed and approved by the Department of Administrative Services Human Resources Services Division. The private security program, the program is responsible for implementing and maintaining standards for training and licensing of private security professionals and is supported with revenue fees and civil penalties. Base budget adjustments, pending...
Madam Chair.
Representative Glickner.
Thank you. Director Minnis.
Yes.
Why are we including civilian penalties to augment the cost for private companies? I can understand the fees, but we're also taking civil penalties to offset their cost?
Madam Chair, Representative, the private security program's statutes authorize the agency to impose civil penalties for violations of orders or revocation. It's to some degree a little bit fuzzy in the sense that oftentimes they may impose a civil penalty, but that civil penalty is not collected, so it becomes an uncollectible. So in one respect, there is a certain amount of civil penalty money that funds the agency is authorized by statute, but I don't believe that it's a great source of cash for this particular program. We do have one individual, I believe, that they assessed $140,000 in civil penalties, but the likelihood of that individual ever paying any of those penalties is remote.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're saying that the private companies, they found this, or it was one of their cases or something, that's why we're giving it back to them? Is that, you know, I still don't understand. If it's a private company, you're saying private security company, so they're the ones that had the civil penalty case pending, and that's why we're giving them part of it back?
Well, it could be, Madam Chair, Representative, it could be a licensee. Or in some instances, a small business who's maybe a sole proprietor who's required to have a license as a private security provider, and that person might find themselves in trouble by, well, perhaps even working and not being certified or having their certification lapse. The Private Security Policy Committee takes an action to revoke that person's certification, and that person continues to work in the field. And usually we find out about they're continuing to work in the field by the local police who've run into the person over and over again doing providing security services. So our investigators will follow through, build a case, and move towards revocation. Once that person revoked, if they fail to respond to the order by the department, then a civil penalty can be ordered. So it's the individual that's responsible.
I understand that.
Bill's got a figure of $6,000 total civil penalties collected in this section.
I'm the only one that doesn't understand that. That makes sense.
Madam Chair.
I'll defer to my
Representative, it would be the same circumstance where you're regulated in terms of, we'll go to the Secretary of State's office, filing contribution expenditure reports. If you fail to file them on time, Secretary of State's office would impose a civil penalty after administrative procedures hearing. Then there is a process and a procedure by which they can ask for a contested case hearing. And once that contested case hearing occurs, if they continue to fail, then they can impose the civil penalty, much like the Secretary of State can impose a civil penalty on any person that fails to file a contribution expenditure report. That's the best parallel I can give you right now.
Is that helpful?
Maybe I'll get it offline.
It's Monday. Mr. McGee?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure this is going to help or not, but I think one thing that's different here than a lot of places in budgets where you see civil penalties is very often, I would guess most often, civil penalties revert to the general fund rather than to the agency that's imposing them. And for whatever reason, the statutes in this case were written to allow the agency to retain the civil penalties for the purpose of operating the program.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, regardless, and I think Mr. Minnis said this, we're not, the amount assumed in 0507 from this is $6,000, so it's a relatively small amount of funding.
Not going to fund drug and alcohol training or anything like that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question on both the fire program and the private security program. We're not asking either of those to make any contribution towards the debt service or towards the cost of the facility, are we? Or are we?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, we are, and Bill can correct me if I'm wrong, in the assessment of a uniform rent rate, which is what we're charging each of these programs for the space that they're assumed to be using. So it's built into that rate.
Okay. Okay. I understand.
Should I continue?
Please.
Madam Chair, thank you. Again, base budget adjustments, pending ratification of fees increased administratively in August of 2003. Wait a second. Is this right?
Gets added back later.
Why don't you jump in here, because I'm getting confused over the fee. There was a fee that was in...
Madam Chair, Mr. Minister is referencing the base budget adjustment, that the pending ratification fees increased administratively. Revenues were reduced by $172,000 here. This was done when the governor's budget was prepared under the assumption that we needed a fee ratification bill for the private security fees that were increased administratively during the biennium. It gets complicated here. We normally do, when there is a fee ratification bill that has to pass the legislature, we back those expenditures and revenues out pending the legislative action to ratify them, because if we don't have your action, the agency has to roll them back. What makes this a little bit more complicated is that the agency, since the governor's budget, has looked again at what their revenue picture is for this program, made the determination it doesn't need the fees that it increased administratively in this biennium, and is going to roll those back. So really, at some point, I think there needs to be a revenue adjustment to occur in the final legislative approved budget. So it's a little more complicated than normal.
Thank you, Bill. We have also the paragraph here on page 31 with all of the usual increases for pension bond assessments and vacancy savings, inflation, et cetera. I'm going to skip down to the total net increase again for this essential package is $7,606 for private security. Policy package 090 reduces services and supplies by $1,317 for anticipated savings from the Smart Vibe program. Policy package 103 includes rent at the new facility, mass transit tax for positions that will move to Salem, and an adjustment for interest fund transfers for central administration services. The package results in an increase of $25,222. Policy package 111 provides $6,356 for reclassification of the private security supervisor position, which was reviewed and approved by the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resources Services Division. Public Safety Memorial Fund was established.
Mr. Wilson.
I don't want to anticipate Mr. Minnis' presentation, but this may be a good place to have an update on the Board of Investigators so we don't let that pass.
Sure, we can do that. My understanding regarding the Board of Investigators is that I had discussions with Linda Gilbert in the Department of Administrative Services, who is the budget management analyst representing the Oregon Board of Investigators. And the direction that we're looking at going now is that the Oregon Board of Investigators would, by statute, assuming that the legislature agrees to do this, cease to exist as a board independent and would become part of the Private Security Policy Committee within the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, adding two positions to the Policy Committee for Private Security. Our agency, in the form of Brian Hansen, who is the supervisor in Private Security, has reviewed the statutes that they currently operate under and also the Board of Investigators statutes and objectives, and believes that the two functions are reasonably concurrent, and believe that we can, or congruent, I should say, and can reasonably operate altogether. A little bit of heartburn, because I think some of the folks within that particular profession would love to have or continue to have their own board, but it, based on cash flow, doesn't appear very feasible.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would that move them more? Would you ultimately need some statutory change also? You're obviously going to need it to change the board, but move them to more of a simply a regulatory body rather than a licensing? Because I don't know in private security if you do much in terms of licensing.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, it's going back a few years there. Apologize. We do both licensing and certification for private security, and it depends on the classification of the man. If you're a private security manager, there's a license. If you're a private security worker, just a general worker, unarmed, it's a certification. There's also an armed certification.
Okay.
So we do do it, and they do believe it is congruent with what we currently do.
Please continue.
Thank you. Moving on to the Public Safety Memorial Fund. This was established in 1999. The fund provides financial assistance to family members of public safety officers who are killed or permanently and totally disabled in the line of duty. Total base budget equals $543,318. The essential package includes 2.4% increase of $12,920 for special payments. No inflation is included for services and supplies due to a statutory limit on administrative costs that can be paid from a particular fund. Policy package 090 reduces the revenue allocation from criminal fines and assessment by $127,665 due to the fund's large balance carry forward. Policy package 096 shifts funding from the criminal fines and assessment account to the general fund in the amount of $105,112. To the administration and support services section, this program includes the director's office, human resources, information services, and business services, which were previously included in the criminal justice program. Operation of the new facility and debt service or financing construction costs is also included in this program. Base budget adjustments, revenues reduced by $216 due to the anticipated balance carry forward from debt service payments. Debt service is adjusted by $9,648,032. Total base budget equals $17,677,051, including debt service, which will be adjusted based on the most recent bond sale by the figure that whatever that ultimately is, $3.4 million roughly. Essential packages included an increase for pension bond assessments, the standard adjustments for vacancy savings, standard inflation for unemployment, phase-out of certificates of participation issuance costs, phase-out of expenditure limitation for the project office, the standard inflation increases for services and supplies, and an adjustment to the state government service charges based on the price list, and a technical adjustment to separate existing expendable property from IT related expendable property. The net total decrease for essential packages is $1,736,117. The policy package 070 reduces other funds by $670,130 and eliminates four positions and 3.71 FTE to match expected available revenue. Reductions include elimination of the government liaison officer, elimination of the executive assistant to the deputy director and training director, and the assistant to the deputy director and the training division director, the elimination of the background investigator, elimination of the accounting technician, and a reduction in services and supplies and information technology expendable property.
Policy Package 090.
Director Minnis, the elimination of the background investigator, could you say more about that and how that function will be carried forward?
Madam Chair, if I could, those positions are added back in. That is a criminal finding assessment.
That's right. Oh,
I believe in 101. They're added back in. But the question's a good one. In the event that we didn't have that particular position, I think we would have a lot of issues that we'd have to deal with. Be very difficult to pick up and do that work. Lost my place here. Policy Package 090 reduces services and supplies by $86,226 based on a review of current biennium expenditures and anticipated savings from Smart Buy. Policy Package 096 shifts funding from the criminal fines and assessment account to the general fund in the amount of $11,947,797 for debt service and $6,817,607 for operations for a total fund shift of $18,765,404. The Policy Package 101 restores the reductions that were included in Policy Package 070 above. Policy Package 101 includes $10,052 for trustee and debt management charges related to the sales of certificates of participation. Expenditure limitation is shifted from services and supplies to funds to fund these charges so that there is no increase in funding. Policy Package 103 includes 21 positions, 15.04 FTE, contracted services and services and supplies for startup and operation of the new facility for a total increase of $5,499,901. Policy Package 104 provides...
Representative Lisnett.
Director Minnis, so I could have waited until I'd asked this in front of Mary if she were here. When is the decision going to be made if you're going to contract out some of these services versus, you know, keeping them in-house?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative, that's your decision. The budget is built, and the department intends to contract out. And we've just recently finished the preliminary RFP, and it's in process. The Attorney General's reviewing the RFP documents, and we'll be going out seeking a vendor for those services. So that is the direction that we've been directed to go, and that is where we are going.
And that was the 8th, Madam Chair. Director Minister, that and that's $800,000 for the annual food service.
I think it was $846,000, roughly $800,000.
Chair, Representative Lisnett, there are three contracts we're talking about. The one is for food service, and that was the $847,000. One is for ground security for $99,100, and the third is for custodial and housekeeping services, $268,000. And the governor recommended contracting those as opposed to state employees. Firstly, because the analysis the department did indicated that it would be less costly to do it that way. Secondly, with the tremendous startup task in front of this agency, going from basically renting two buildings in Western Oregon campus to running a 250-acre campus on a 24/7 basis, it was felt that it would be more efficient to bring in someone who's already running those businesses, put them in place, let them get it started up and operating. If at a point in time it looked like it would be more appropriate 5-10 years down the road for the state to take over those functions, that could be a later decision. But initially, for the startup and the lower cost, the recommendation was to contract.
Madam Chair, then we're not going to, that's, if we approve the budget like it is, then that includes contracting out those services.
Thank you. As a matter of course, our internal discussions with respect to having state employees versus contracting out, this is rough, but we assume it would roughly double the cost that we have in the budget to do that. A little bit more expensive.
Representative Hansen.
Well, a couple of quick questions. The $840,000 for the food, that's annual basis or biennial?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that would be 1 year, so it would double
okay.
for a 2 year.
Okay. The other one, and we don't have to get into it super deep now, but maybe sometime before. It looks like the policy package is 103, going back to the fire program and private security program. Have the include rent at the new facility. Now, if that's where we're talking about those two programs helping to pay for the new facility, we're talking about. I'd like to see how that their portion is allocated to them, because we're paying like $9 million debt service on a facility and netting $25,000 and $40,000 on the two increases. So I'm thinking there must be something else there.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there is a chargeback based on the square footage that those programs are using. They're primarily not on-campus training facilities, so what their space will be mostly is their administrative staff, some of the training coordinators, the certification staff. So they're not using a tremendous amount of square footage of the facility. The uniform rent rate the department is charging is based on what they use. We'll bring back some numbers to you tomorrow that will give you some more detail.
Mr. Wilson, did you have a comment on this one? Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Policy Package 104 provides $497,500 to begin a four biennium upgrade of our operations management software, hardware, and databases. The first phase includes acquisition and installation of a centralized database that will be used to manage student registration, housing, class management at the new facility. And I can get into that a little bit deeper at some point, but the bottom line is we have a real hodgepodge of databases and information that are kept in a multiplicity of access databases that people have created as they've gone along. This is a concept to try to integrate that data and actually make it more usable. And an example, when I took over the department, I asked our academy training folks to provide information for me relevant to how many part-time trainers we have, who they are, where they come from, how often they train. It took them a little over 40 hours to pull all of that information together and gave me three binders of copied material. The idea in the information technology network area here is to develop a system that any manager within the agency can pull that information up at any time. And as we're looking at the new facility and the implementation of technology there, I don't know how much we'll get into in these discussions, but the campus will be wired with wireless internet access with various security limitations depending on where you are in the facility. Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Georgia uses a very similar system that actually allows the instructors to have in a Palm Pilot type PDA device the current curriculum for the training coordinators that are doing training at Blessing. We would hope to be able to do the same thing and through the wireless internet access be able to download the instructor's evaluation to particular students on a real-time basis and make that information available to managers on a day-to-day basis. Another example is when our folks finish their basic academy class, currently they go to a disk and enter their information evaluating the basic training program at the end of the class or near the end of the 10-week training program. My hope is that we'll have information available to us on a day-to-day basis regarding how people in the classes are receiving the instruction, how they feel the instructors are doing in terms of providing adequate instruction. We're finding that much of the information lags by weeks, if not months, and it's very hard to go back and correct a difficulty or problem with a trainer or even some student behavior if we don't find out about it until months later.
What is the total cost of the four biennium upgrade? The $497,500, just the first phase at the startup.
Madam Chair, we can get that to you. I don't know that we have those figures with us. I'm assuming it's roughly about $2 million. But that's a guess. It's been a long time since the information technology director presented his strategic plan to us. I think his strategic plan to implement these four phases goes all the way out to, I believe, 2016. Would I like to have the technology earlier? Absolutely, but he's a very practical man.
And this is a package or a proposal that has made its way to the joint information technology, that appropriate legislative committee for their review?
Madam Chair, we have not taken that to that committee at this point. This was included in the governor's budget because based on our review of it, we didn't see how the agency would be able to manage the facility without it. As the text here that talks about, the first phase will really focus heavily on student registration, housing, class management, just be able to make sure that the people are where they should be and the facilities are adequate to run everything at one time, that buildings and spaces aren't double booked. So this is a significant reason why we recommend this.
Madam Chair, we don't have any problem at all bringing it before any legislative committee. In fact, I think it would be very enlightening for them to see, you know, what the Information Technology Director has envisioned here. He's very visionary.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, it would be my intent that if they're not ready, the development of this, to go in front of the committee during the current session, that we would recommend probably unscheduling this amount and have them come back during the interim sometime.
All right.
Scheduling a portion of the amount so that we're giving a little bit to work on before they go to the committee.
Very good. Well, then we will expect...
I think the director wants to make some comments.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Matt, Doug's just freaking me out a little bit here. But, the difficulty with that, and I'll just raise this flag and we can talk offline, and I don't know that the full amount of money is necessary up front or what point, but this information technology system requires it's a huge RFP process that's going to the Attorney General's office now for review, but it requires early work to hopefully be up and running and available to us when we move into the facility, not afterwards. Otherwise, we continue to do what we currently do, and it's not very good. But anyway, we can talk about that later, and it may very well be that it's amenable to phasing in the money. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Two little brief issues. Madam Chair, policy package 105 includes three limited duration positions, 2.01 FTE, to be phased out in October of 2006 to manage the construction of the new facility. Funding is $343,608, and the funding is from the certificates of participation revenue in the construction budget. Policy package 111 includes reclassification of two positions that have been reviewed and approved by the Department of Administrative Services. Human Resources Services Division expenditure limitation is shifted to services and supplies to fund the reclassifications so that there is no increase in funding. Madam Chair.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask a couple of just general questions here? That we haven't really gotten there, and if we're getting to this point, tell me, and if we're not, we can talk maybe just briefly now. When you did your projections, what's the total number of students or trainees per month at this facility? Do you have a number for that?
Chair and Representative, I'm not sure that it fluctuates between 150 to 300 depending on how many classes are on campus at any time. I believe we have two police academy classes currently running, one corrections academy, and we've had one mental management class and a leadership class ongoing. So again, it depends on how many of these varying classes are in residence at the academy, so between 150 to 300.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. How many is the housing good for? 200, 300?
It's roughly 300. There are a number of ADA retrofitted rooms for individuals that have those kind of requirements, but I believe it's close to 300, maybe just a little shy of that.
Okay. And follow-up, Madam Chair. Will you be 7 days a week, or will you just operate primarily business hours, business days?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that the general assumption is we are 5 days a week, general business hours, however, comma. The winter fire school comes in at least one time a year. Is there a summer fire school? So the winter fire school for weekend activity, there are generally some evening training ongoing, range 3000. Defense tactics, physical agility training, this kind of thing, physical fitness training. Not all students participate, and one example of this, Department of Corrections students tend not to participate in the evening training because it results in overtime, and because it results in overtime, we try to shy away from that. So there generally is training ongoing until about 8 or 9 o'clock at night, depending on the evening.
And Saturdays?
Not very often on Saturdays. My vision would be that we would basically be running this thing as often as possible, but clearly that requires.
Yes.
Representative Buchanan, did you wish to?
As we go through and try to determine costs, it's like we do schools and many other things. It's nice to get a number in your head so you can begin to allocate costs against the number of instructors, number of students, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Other fund balances, I believe.
Let's see. We do have another in Appendix E for summary totals. Because most funding for criminal justice training and certification agency administration operations of debt services shifted from the criminal fines and assessment public safety fund revenues to general fund, there will be a minimal ending balance in other funds for these programs. The agency will be expected to expend all other fund carried over from the 2003-2005 biennium prior to making general fund expenditures. The ending balance for the fire training program is anticipated to provide a cash balance sufficient to cover approximately about 2 months of operating expenses, and personal services increases roughly 8%. The projected ending balance for the private security program has increased since the initial preparation of the budget and is equal to more than 7 months of operating expenses and personal services increases about 8%. And as I'm saying, is that based on? That's based on the higher fee. The 7 month is based on the higher fee that has been rolled back, so it won't be quite 7 months once that's rolled back.
Mr. McGee? If I could make one point on the display in Appendix E, the $1.2 million you're seeing is at the bottom of the column. The difference, the increased ending balance for 305, we have taken that into account in the adjustment we proposed to you for the governor's, essentially the governor's revision. So there will not be a carryover at the end of 0507 based on the revision we're proposing to you.
All right. Madam Chair, we now move to the summary of proposed legislation. Senate Bill 57 is a bill that would permit the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and the Board to develop fees and guidelines for use of the facility of the Oregon Public Safety Academy for non-mandated training provided to federal, state, and other governmental agencies, private entities, and individuals. That bill has passed the Senate and is currently residing in the House Judiciary Committee, but has not been assigned to hearing. Senate Bill 61, private security changes. Proposed changes simplify current law by specifying the training requirements and contents of an application shall be determined by rule rather than by statute, and the creation of a Class A violation for providing private security services without having appropriate certification in possession. This is also potentially the bill or vehicle that would include the Oregon Board of Investigators statutory revisions in it, given the Senate Judiciary Chair and House Judiciary Chair consent to those amendments, and assume that the bill would end up having to come to Ways and Means for its final work. That bill has passed the Senate and is currently again in the House Judiciary Committee. Senate Bill 62 allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to add private entities to the current list of those whom the Department of Public Safety and Standards Training, in consultation with the board, may provide grants. The concept here is that this agency deals to a large degree with the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Sheriff's Associations, and other associations who represent constituent groups within our agency, and it's our objective to try to work more collaboratively with them in the development and delivery of training that we can work and do in concert. And what we're attempting to do here is provide some resources where it's appropriate that the agency and these organizations are furthering the mission of delivering high-quality training. And I won't get into some of the other issues that might evolve around this in terms of contracting issues and such on and so forth. It's not necessarily an attempt to get around the current contracting restriction, but it's really an idea to allow us to participate more fully with some of our partners, and certainly this is contingent upon funding within the agency and available resources to do that. Senate Bill 63 provides the authority to deny application for training as a public safety officer, literally at the front end of the training. What we have currently is a situation where someone may be hired by an agency. They will enter into a basic training program and upon completion find that they have a violation of law that would be a discretionary disqualifier. And the board subsequently then revokes the individual or denies that person's certification to the career. This bill would allow the agency, we're currently not allowed to do this, would allow us to do that preliminary review before the person enters the academy so that they don't run into the same roadblock at the end of the academy that some students have found themselves in. In other words, the board can make a determination before the student enters the academy.
The example that you're giving involves a violation of law.
Correct.
Would not that violation of law be picked up in a background investigation?
Madam Chair, it could very well be picked up in a background investigation, although I'll tell you that it isn't very uniform what's happening in law enforcement with respect to background investigations. A background investigation in Oregon may be as simple as a reference check that a chief of police might do and calling some friends and relatives that are listed on an application as opposed to an in-depth background investigation that would go very deep into the person's background history, run a criminal career criminal history and state leads, driver's records, credit history, this kind of thing, and actually interviewing neighbors. Just as a matter of course, a little bit of interest, the California Highway Patrol spends $7,000 on every background investigation that they do. And they do an extremely in-depth investigation, and their belief is that to the extent that you provide that background in-depth, you end up with a higher quality employee at the beginning of their careers. We do have a very spotty system in Oregon with respect to requirements for background investigations. We're having our rules do require a background investigation, but it doesn't say specifically what that background investigation might be. So hence, we do have people who've been hired. They've worked for months. One case over on the Oregon coast, the fellow has been there for 8 months. He shows up in our academy. One of the other students recognizes this person. In essence, indicated that there had been a problem in a previous class some 5 years before. And sure enough, this person was entered into some problems that involved the Attorney General's office and fairly in-depth background problems. They were hired notwithstanding. Bottom line is this person had never been certified as a police officer, had worked for about 6 years in law enforcement in Oregon without having ever been certified and having ever been through a basic training program in the state system. And that person was obviously relieved of his duties in our academy. And I actually had that particular chief of police sit in my office and tell me that he understood how this person could lie to me. We had to say that we don't agree and don't understand how this person could lie, and frankly, that's a problem. So, bottom line, and you also would have some criminal convictions that may be a discretionary disqualifier that the chief of police or somebody may review. They may know about it, but they're really, you know, they're betting that the person's going to be able to get through the process and be certified, but the board may take a different position.
What I'm hearing, though, in everything that you said is that we would still not have a standard for completing background investigations.
I'm sorry. I did not hear you.
I'm trying to understand whether we are moving toward having a standard for conducting background investigations in the absence of any statutory authority.
Madam Chair, I believe the board does have the current power and the authority to impose that kind of a standard. I don't know that we have an actual description within the administrative rule of what a background investigation may look like. Eric's
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Gablich, Deputy Director of the Department. That is an issue based on some of our experiences in recent months that we will be taking forward to both the Police Policy Committee and eventually the Corrections Policy Committee, and then those will basically wind their way up to the board, and that is exactly the challenge. Our rules currently say that officers will go through a background. However, across the state, what a background is defined differently in each local municipality or county. So we will basically work with our process to establish what a comprehensive background looks like and adopt that process in rule.
So what is the timeline for achieving that goal?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've had initial discussions with both the chiefs and some sheriffs. We will probably have that on their agenda within their next quarterly meeting and probably have that hopefully resolved within the next year. And the only reason, Madam Chair, that it would take so long is because through the public rulemaking process, the ability to collect comment, to really develop, it takes us roughly a year to get something comprehensive in place.
Well, it's, you know, I'm just saying the obvious. It's troubling to hear that we don't have a standard, but it's also troubling to hear that it would take that long to get there. And then to hear that California spends $7,000 on its background check process, whatever it is, I'm almost afraid to ask what we spend in comparison, but I will ask.
Madam Chair, as far as exact figures, I'm going to give you a rough guess what our costs are currently. We're probably $300 to $500 for our current system.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
But that... That wouldn't include what the local governments were spending on their pre...
That's correct, Madam Chair. It would not.
I know Multnomah County, it's a pretty expensive process before someone's ever hired. That they send the officers out to do the retired sheriff's deputies that go out and interview family and friends, and it's a pretty comprehensive process. I'm assuming it would be comparable.
Madam Chair, most large agencies do have a fairly comprehensive background policy. It's the smaller agencies with much smaller budgets that are perhaps a little bit more motivated to hire somebody without a comprehensive background investigation that you might find these kind of problems.
But the issue is standard.
Exactly.
Standard.
In one of the, if I might, Madam Chair, I just attended the IATLIST, International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training, Western Region meeting in Nevada. California Post publishes a standardized background investigation personal history form on their website. It's a development that I'm working on internally in our agency to do something similar in posting a standardized form so that all agencies at least would have that available to them. Because what you'll find is over time the law changes, case law changes, some of the questions that you might have been able to ask 5 years ago you can no longer ask. California just recently went through the legal review on theirs, updated all of their background forms and their questions on personal history. We've done very similar work internally in the department in upgrading our own internal background investigation and work with the Department of Justice to ensure that our personal history forms are consistent with federal and state laws and not asking inappropriate or illegal questions. And it's very possible to get that kind of a form up and running within the next number of months. But communication externally to the departments outside is probably the more difficult task, taking the message out and communicating to the agencies that, one, it's available, two, there's a benefit in using it in that the Attorney General has vetted the questions and by virtue of the fact that they're reviewing all of the legal issues, incur some vicarious liability in defending the use of the form. And we have to a large degree, sell the benefits of that kind of work to many of the smaller agencies.
Representative, I know that background checks, this is an area that you have been paying close attention to in a couple of committees, and I wanted to invite you to make any comments that occur to you before we move away.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. No, Director Minnis, what the Chair is talking about is, especially in education, you know, we've been looking at this with the other agencies coming in now. Yes. We're also concerned about the state police going up from $26 to $50. $2 investigation, what that entails, and I understand I've been through a lot of checks myself, and I understand there's different levels and things like that, but I think it's important, especially people delivering direct service, we're trying to look at that and be sure we need to change to be sure, you know, we're everyone that needs to have a background check and what kind of check gets it, and that the fees. You know, we're also, Madam Chair, I don't know if I've even talked to you about this, you know, there's a bill out there, too, for nonprofits not to pay as much for their background checks, otherwise you're taking away money from nonprofits. The people that need don't have a lot of money to pay for these things.
I have heard about that. Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, later in the week you'll have the state police in front of you, and I've made sure they need to talk about the background checks and the fees that they're increasing. The problem is, over the past few years, the state police have had some significant reductions in general fund in that area and are operating quite a bit under sort of demand capacity at this time. And so they have increased their fees after reviewing with the emergency board in January or
March
November.
Sorry, Madam Chair, but I think it went up in March, did it not?
Yes, I think it did after visiting with the e-board in January, I believe. There's also another fee bill out there for the background checks, increasing the fees for handgun owners or the insti checks. And the other one would be the concealed weapons. So that'll be an issue you probably have in front of you later this week for discussion.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
One of my concerns, and I hope it doesn't happen, I'm not positive it couldn't happen, though, is that when we talk about these extensive background checks where we actually put people out in the field, I'm concerned that there could be a very attractive candidate for a law enforcement position, a young person that's done very well in school and is, you know, applying everywhere, and that they would be investigated by the city of Portland, Multnomah County, Washington County, and the state police at a couple grand a pop, you know, until their relatives started ending up hating them because they were being interviewed four times a week. But sometimes I wonder if there, I would hope there'd be at some point some type of a uniformity that if one background check could serve multiple agencies until a candidate was hired, or that once they went through that same check.
Madam Chair, I mean, what you're, at least I assume you're alluding to, is whether this department could somehow consolidate those kind of activities and do background investigations on a statewide level.
Well, I wouldn't care who did it, or if Multnomah County had already thoroughly investigated somebody and then decided that, yeah, their background was fine, but the position didn't open up or something, that the city of Portland or somebody else could use that same kind of, maybe just have your agency certify the standards for the background check or something, so that they could be used by multiple agencies.
The Madam Chair, certification of the standards would be clearly doable. The other option would increase our staffing and budget exponentially. Probably not a bad thing to do, but it would shift the cost from the locals to the state. Probably not a feasible option, I would think. And just as a curiosity, when I became a Portland police officer, Multnomah County at the time, back in the 70s, if you failed the psych test for Multnomah County, you were guaranteed to pass the psych test for Portland. If you failed the Portland psych test, you were guaranteed to pass the Multnomah County psych test, because they had dueling clinical psychologists that didn't like each other. So odd circumstances. So some of this is very subjective.
Actually, the former mental health director for Multnomah County told me that he applied as a deputy for Multnomah County and was turned down because he was too aggressive, and I told him that he should apply to Portland. And he ended up, he was our mental health director.
Madam Chair, when I was hired by the Portland Police Department, I was a reserve deputy sheriff in Multnomah County, and the regular deputy said, "Congratulations, John, you've just been hired by the Black Glove Department." I said, "What do you mean?" No clue, but I think it has something to do with what you're chatting about. I don't think that was the case, but nonetheless, that was the perception. So, anyway.
You said that it would be a year? approximately a year before we had a standard to look at?
Madam Chair, again for the record, Eric Alex, our processes seem to take, especially substantial rules, processes that we're implementing, on the average of a year in its longest format. We could obviously use the administrative rule process and have an emergency rule put in place for a temporary rule, but really I think Director Mendez stated the biggest challenge with our process, because it does involve the board and so many constituents, is getting people on board. And I think that the Representative Hansen's comments about some larger agencies, Multnomah County, City of Gresham, that have full-time investigators, would probably have no problem with this concept. But when you look across the state, the challenges truly become in the smaller communities, where they don't have a background investigator. They assign it to a sergeant or an officer to look into it. And it's really outreaching to those communities and get them on board. And that's, I think, in our experience, where the bigger challenges are. It's not from the larger agencies of full-time investigators. It's those that may hire a person once every 3 years that don't do these quite often. So that's why it would take it the longest a year, but we could do our best to expedite that process.
Well, if you ask the question, why do we need standards, I would answer it in a way that says, because we want professionalism, and nothing short of professionalism across the board. No matter where you live, no matter which county, where in the state, that's what we should be, hopefully, striving toward. And some of the anecdotes kind of underscore the need to make sure that's where we're headed. You want to continue on with the...
Madam Chair, there is one other component part to Senate Bill
63,
and that is allowing the board to adopt rules governing when a person can reapply for certification once they've been revoked. Currently, the law is silent in that they're allowed to reapply 4 years after being revoked, notwithstanding the reason why they were revoked. So if they were revoked for a mandatory sex crime, for instance, a crime that would be a mandatory decertification, they could still reapply, even though there's no way that they're ever going to get recertified based on that conviction. But this would give us the authority to define those kind of character or categories where they would not be allowed to reapply. Lastly, Senate Bill 65, Civil Penalty Authority. This gets us back into the discussion we had with private security. This bill was designed to allow the agency to impose civil penalties against public safety agencies and some private entities, ambulance companies, for instance, that employ some certified staff who refuse to not employ someone who's been revoked. In that instance, it's happened a number of different times. Not a huge problem. The civil penalties in this particular bill would inure to the benefit of the general fund and not to the program. Be just the opposite of what the private security program is like. That bill is still in Senate Judiciary, and in my conversation with Senator Burdick is that she's not really that thrilled with the bill, so it may not be moving forward unless I can convince her otherwise.
House Bill 5062.
Sorry about that.
Madam Chair, that's the bill that's in front of this subcommittee and assigned.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is, again, the bill approving fee increases for private security provider licensing and certification. Fees were adopted administratively, and as we referenced earlier, the private security fee is being rolled back simply because they were accumulating, I think, a fairly large cash balance. And once we directed them to take a good look at that cash balance and its accumulation and what factors were involved in it, it was determined that they did not need the fee. So it was rolled back. I think the earlier discussion about 7 months of reserves of private security showed an ending balance of roughly $460,000. Accumulating there. Once we roll the fee back, which is what's going to happen, it will accumulate $289,000. So it's rolled back quite a bit. They still have a fairly large carry forward in their account, so they're going to be fine. I do have some charts. I don't know if you want to go to this, but this is a further breaks down the administration support services charges. With Mr. McGee's presentation, Twenty-two percent of the agency in administration support, so we thought it might be prudent for you to see a breakdown of that so that it didn't look like we were so heavy in administration that we were tipping over.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lipnett.
Before we run out of time, Mr. Minnis talked about before going through how he's trying to work with the OSP on their training program. Mr. Minnis, have you responded to the chief, to the OSP January letter?
I have not responded in writing, Superintendent. I've had a number of conversations about the letter and what it may or may not mean.
Good conversations, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe they're good conversations. I believe the Superintendent is providing his good faith effort to cooperate with us.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Did you want to talk with Representative Hanna?
I was hoping that Representative Hansen would pass that form on around.
I thought there were three separate ones.
Sure.
Three for you.
Madam Chair, I also have the debt service figures. I'm going to pass those out.
It's a slow day.
It's based on
interest. Madam Chair.
Representative Hammond.
Director Minnis, I thought I heard you say 22% for admin and support. Was it maybe 22 million?
No, 22 million. I'm sorry.
Okay. I just want to make sure so we're on the same page.
I'll get lost in my own binder. So.
Good catch, Representative Hammond.
Which one would you like to?
Let's start with the pie and then go to the debt schedule.
Again, if you look at the program and support services section of Mr. McGee's presentation, this just breaks that number down into 53% of that, or almost 54% of that total number is debt service. And on around the board, 4.52% for the director, deputy director. Boards and commission, 0.07%. WU damages, 41%, and that's the $90,000 damages that the agency is required to pay WU once we leave. Human resources, 3.14%. Information services, 8.1%. Business services, 5.3%. Government service charges, 1.9%. Other COP costs, and I assume that's the underwriting costs and issuance costs, et cetera. And facilities operation, 12.87, which, of course, are COP dollars for the construction management team out there. And then startup costs, 8.25%. And then construction project office
cost.
Facilities operations is not. That is the operation of the facility, the budgeted positions we're going to bring on to run the facility. Construction project office is the project management team. There, so that further breaks it down for you so that you can hopefully see where those numbers are. I don't know if you need an explanation of the debt service schedule or not. I think it rolls up to the 9.875 million dollar figure, correct? And that would include the reduction of 3.4.
Are there any questions on this? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Just to clarify, this represents a total fund amount updated for the pass or the sale that was completed last week.
Right. Okay. So an all bond or all COPs have been issued. So the project is fully funded at this point.
Madam Chair, keep in mind, and please correct me if I'm wrong, in the table, the 11.3 and 0709 will likely have to be entirely general fund or, however, CFA or general fund. So there will be a roll-up in debt service cost here because of the use of the savings or carried forward from the current biennium that generated part of the $3.4 million savings. So it is another roll-up cost into the next biennium.
Madam Chair, Doug, I didn't hear exactly what you were saying.
I was just saying that the roll-up in 0709 is going to be general fund and will be even more so general fund because of the use of one-time savings and capitalized interest to pay for the current or the decrease, part of the decrease of the 3.4 that was discussed earlier. So there are some significant roll-up costs, debt service, even going into the next biennium.
And Madam Chair, thank you. The true interest cost, like on the April 05 COPs, that's not your net interest cost because you must have interest income based on those COP sales currently, correct? So this is not net of that.
That's Elaine Sears, by the way, for the record.
Do we have that number somewhere, the net interest income from the COP sales? Where is that built into the budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, I believe that rate is 4.29%. And that's the... I think the rate you're asking for is the 4.29%, which would be the rate exclusive of the earnings.
The rate exclusive of the earnings.
That's the earnings.
That would mean we're only earning, Madam Chair.
You're inquiring about the earnings.
Yes.
For the April 205, are you wanting to go further back? Or?
Well, Madam Chair, it's just, I mean, I'm kind of working off the top of my head here, and I don't totally know the intimacy of the project, but if we sold $43 million worth of bonds in April and the interest cost on them is 449, it's likely we haven't had that expenditure yet. In other words, we sold the bonds, so we have the money.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we've got to have interest income coming in. And if the net interest is 4.29, that would indicate we're only earning 0.29 interest margin, which doesn't seem...
Yeah, I misinterpreted the question.
Okay.
When we do a sale, we do make we determine, work with the agency to find out what the cash flow projection is off the sale. We do make assumptions on the amount of interest earnings that we will get. And we do use those interest earnings as part of the project, the assumption of project costs. So, am I getting to your question?
I think you are, Madam Chair. I'm going to follow up, please. So you're projecting the earnings of interest income on the bond sale.
So we only sell enough to generate enough, including the interest earnings.
Thank you. Do you understand where I went with all of that? It's a little confusing, but I got to looking at $43 million and thinking we had to have a lot of interest income here because we hadn't spent it all. But that answers the question.
Representative Hanson.
Well, one of the things that's kind of interesting to comment is we look at the true interest costs going back to May 02, and even with the jumps in the Federal Reserve rates and stuff, those are really incredibly consistent for over a three-year period. I'm surprised there's only 0.7 of a percent difference between the ones in October and today. Probably the difference between 30 years and short term.
Madam Chair, there are many, there are a number of variables that go into that, including the size of the issue and the other projects that may be included in that issue. Now, for the most recent April 2005, I think this $43 million was the majority or the vast majority of that April 2003 or 2005 sale. But there are lots of factors that go into that calculation.
Colleagues, we are nearing the close of today's meeting, and I do want to announce that on Tuesday, the Phase 2 presentation by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training will continue, and public testimony on their budget is scheduled. On Wednesday and Thursday, the state police's budget is scheduled for the Phase 2 presentation. Are there any closing comments for the good of the order, Representative Hansen?
Well, the same question that Senator Devlin raised in terms of how we're going to deal with criminal fines and assessment, that overall decision in terms of the state police funding vis-a-vis line games, general fund, whatever, at some point that probably needs to be made before we can get very far in quite a number of our budgets.
Absolutely, and we will need some guidance and direction, frankly, from the co-chairs, and in addition to that, any wisdom, recommendations that members of this subcommittee have, please bring those forward as well. Representative Wisnow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. McGee, I had people in the day from COBRA, and they're also affected by that decision, right? Their money now will not come from crimes and the fines, but will come from the general fund.
Madam Chair, is that one of the child abuse?
Yeah. COBRA.
That would also be a shift. We'll spend some more time talking about this, but we would make the argument that effectively CFA money and general fund money are the same. When you increase the budget for this agency, you are at the same time decreasing the money that goes into the general fund. So we believe that it is basically completely interchangeable. That it has been so over its history. It's been used for a whole variety of different areas: natural resources, transportation, public safety, human services. We think that there are ways the mechanism results in some reductions in general fund that Mr. Minnis talked to you about earlier that occurred in the last biennium because of the mechanism. And as we've also pointed out, Mr. Minnis pointed out, actually Doug pointed out, that if you make the switch back, it'll cost you about $2 million just to leave a cash balance for DPSST to deal with their cash flow needs and their compensation increases over the biennium. So we think, in the whole, it does make sense to maintain the governor's recommendation to keep this as general fund. But we can spend more time making that argument another time.
We'll spend some more time on this subject. Mr. Wilson?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how much Mr. Minnis has left in his presentation for tomorrow, the public hearing, but I may ask Mr. McGee to be ready to do that CFA mm-hmm. presentation tomorrow.
That would be a natural
given that it's
segue.
Timely and fashion.
Natural segue.
Well, I know that Mr. McGee is very competent and capable, and it would be helpful, I think, for the committee to understand why there has to be an ending balance when you go to criminal fines and assessment. And it has a lot to do with the accounting mechanisms that are set up and how the agency receives funds as an underfunded agency versus a general fund agency. And it's one of those funny little nuances of the accounting system.
Well, Madam Chair, it's really two reasons. One is just the cash flow, so they have enough cash coming in to pay their bills. General fund, we give them an appropriation every quarter, and that money is guaranteed. When they're bringing money from another source, that is variable. There needs to be enough just to move cash flow with any business. In addition, the way that we deal with the compensation increases that occur during the biennium is different from general fund agencies and non-general fund agencies. As you know, there's $130 million in the governor's budget that's recommended to the emergency board to deal with salary increases and benefit increases that will occur during the biennium that will be negotiated. That deals with agencies that directly get general fund. An agency that is other funded needs to carry a sufficient balance that they can self-fund those salary increases and compensation increases. So that's another reason why we need to retain some cash inside of agencies. For DPSST, what we would normally recommend to you would be 2 months cash balance just to deal with the cash flow issues and 8% personal services to deal with the compensation increases. That would leave about $2 million more than we have now and would require you, in essence, to reduce $2 million that you could otherwise spend on programs if you leave the money as a general fund appropriation.
We'll pick this up on tomorrow, and if there's no further business, then we are adjourned.
Thank you.